Russian forces pressing ahead with their military operation in areas in eastern and southern Ukraine. The Yemeni army says it has shot down a Saudi spy drone over the northwestern city of Hajja. The Chinese capital shuts nearly 200 subway stations and bus routes in an attempt to keep COVID in check. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Russian forces pressing ahead with their military operation in areas in eastern and southern Ukraine. The Russian army has carried out a major attack on a steel plant in the southern city of Mariupol, where a UN-brokered evacuation operation is underway. Moscow says Ukrainian troops are using the break in fighting to take up combat positions in the city. More than 150 people have already been evacuated from Mariupol in the Donetsk region. Local authorities say attacks by Russian forces killed 21 civilians on Tuesday. Meanwhile, the European Union is preparing fresh sanctions on Russian oil sales, but there are divisions among member states, with Slovakia seeking exemption from the embargo. We've talked to our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, to get more details about the EU's new sanctions on Russia. Let's listen.
That this is the sixth round of sanctions being proposed by the European Commission. And as you mentioned, you know, it's a proposal from the European Commission. They formulate the sanctions, and then it's up to the European Council to basically agree on it. That's the 27 member states, the EU leaders. And of course, it has to be rubber stamped finally in the European Parliament. But there are divisions, and that's because, you know, the repercussions, as you mentioned, we heard statements like, you know, the EU doesn't want to shoot itself in the foot during this debate in the European Parliament. But in terms of the sanctions itself, von der Leyen outlined more individuals will be placed on the EU sanction list, more Russian individuals, mainly involved in Russia's military. There's a proposal to take Russia's largest bank out of the SWIFT financial transfer payment system, which is a significant move from a financial perspective. A number of media organizations, more media, Russian media organizations, are being banned from EU airwaves. But the big one is the complete ban on the import of Russian oil between now and the end of the year. And no mention specifically of gas, of course. The big questions, some of the questions being asked in the European Parliament today, is how might Russia respond? Because, of course, we do import a lot of oil from Russia, but the big one is the gas. And therefore, if Russia decides, for example, decides to disrupt the supply of gas to more EU countries, like we saw in Poland and Bulgaria, what could be the financial implications for the European Union? So a lot of questions like that. Also, lawmakers were asking the questions, do sanctions work? I mean, don't forget, we're talking about six rounds of sanctions now, but I mean, the EU has been applying sanctions on Russia since 2014. Many lawmakers are saying that the sanctions don't work, that sanctions do not work, because, you know, the EU is it's not the case that it's the only show in town for Russia. Russia can also do business with many other countries and so on. Therefore, the effectiveness of the sanctions is being called into question.
A top Russian investigator says the United States has been involved in Ukraine's bioweapons development program. Alexander Bastrikin says the analyses of obtained documents show representatives from the Pentagon and certain American firms have been involved in biological military activities in Ukraine. The Russian investigator says Washington has spent over $224 million since 2008 on such programs in Ukraine. He says the sum has been funneled into about 30 research centers run by Ukraine's defense, health, and agricultural ministries. Russia has long accused Ukraine of pursuing a U.S.-funded bioweapons program. That amid Washington's allegations that Moscow could launch a chemical attack on its western neighbor, a claim the Kremlin vehemently denies. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett says American and Israeli intelligence operatives have been engaged in bio labs in Ukraine since 2005.
We knew over a year ago about these bio labs and their experiments and the documents. We knew about the contractors. We knew about it originally starting in 2005 with the Defense Intelligence Agency that then created a 501c3 called the Global Viral Forecasting Institute with a Zionist Mossad operative named Nathaniel Wolf that then became Metabiota to make it more of a harmless name. And that Metabiota was being funded by Rosemont Fonseca, an investment firm that, ironically enough, Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, was the head of, along with Christopher Hines, who was the son of John Kerry, and Paul Pelosi Jr., the son of Nancy Pelosi. So this is a incestuous, corrupt, criminal racketeering operation that the West has been developing under Obama, under Biden, under, you know, for the last 10 years, for the purposes of generating DNA biological chemical warfare to use against the Russians. That's why they've been collecting DNA samples from Slavic people. And of course, all of the documents and the evidence that General Igor Krylyov has found and commented on are all being exposed as revelations of a massive, really war crime, crime against humanity, because it's a violation of the Global Biological Chemical Weapons Agreement.
Yemen says its air defenses have shot down a Saudi spy drone flying over its airspace. According to Yemeni media, the drone was downed over the northwestern city of Hadra. Yemen's military has already brought down dozens of drones operated by the Saudi-led coalition in recent years. The incident comes amid a UN-brokered ceasefire agreement reached between the warring sides on April the 1st. Yemen says a coalition has on multiple occasions violated the truce by launching attacks. Well, China is taking more precautionary measures to contain the spread of COVID, with the capital Beijing shutting down dozens of subway stations and bus routes a day after the city recorded 51 infections. Authorities have gradually begun imposing restrictions, and people fear they would face sudden stay-at-home orders. Housing compounds with reported infections have already been locked down, while tourist sites are tightening their rules and restaurants closing their doors. The central city of Zhengzhou has also ramped up controls, with residents in some areas remaining in their housing compounds. Officials say the measures are aimed at avoiding the fate of commercial hub Shanghai, where millions have been under strict lockdown for over a month. China has been battling its worst flare-up since the early days of the pandemic. North Korea has test-launched yet another ballistic missile amid worries on the Korean Peninsula over its nuclear program. The South Korean military says it detected the launch in the Sunan area of Pyongyang. It says the missile flew for about 470 kilometers toward the sea off the North's east coast. It comes a week after the North Korean leader vowed to accelerate the development of his country's nuclear arsenal, calling it a symbol of national power. Kim Jong-un also said that the North would not shy away from the preemptive use of nuclear weapons to counter hostile forces. This year alone, North Korea has fired 14 short- and long-range ballistic missiles. The country has doubled down on Kim's military modernization drive as well as missile tests, while ignoring the offer of talks from the United States. Our Seoul correspondent Jennifer Chang joined us earlier with details about North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
We have to see what kind of missile this is, and those results of the investigation will come out later. However, just last week, the North paraded its Hwasong-17 monster ICBM, which the U.S. missile defenses are helpless to stop. This missile can hit any point in the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. And so this is going to be what the focal point will be. The North had fired a missile, an ICBM missile, which it said was the Hwasong-17, last month, but the U.S. and South Korea claimed that this was not the Hwasong-17, but the Hwasong-15, an earlier version. And Pyongyang is eager to show that it is indeed firing off the Hwasong-17. Now, the Hwasong-17 is different from the Hwasong-15 because it has multiple warheads and decoys that can evade any U.S. missile defense systems.
A new data leak shows a foreign client of the Israeli firm NSO selected over 200 Spanish mobile numbers to target them with its spyware Pegasus. Based on the leak, the selections were made by Morocco in 2019 and were part of more than 50,000 numbers to target to buy NSO clients worldwide. Just days ago, another revelation showed that Pegasus had infected the phones of Spain's prime minister and defense minister that year. The government has already launched an investigation. Madrid is also facing questions over how Pegasus was allegedly used to monitor Catalan leaders following a failed 2017 referendum there. Spain was then engaged in a tense diplomatic row with Morocco. Rabat denies spying on any foreign leaders using the Israeli malware. NSO has also rejected any link with the leak, but it's known for selling the spyware to government clients. Administrative detention is an illegal practice that Israel uses extensively and routinely to hold Palestinians. The incarceration has no time limit, and the charges, if any, are never disclosed. The number of Palestinians held under this measure has hit a record high since 2016, but the international community is keeping silent on administrative detention, as it does with the other apartheid practices of the Israeli regime. And this is seen as a green light for Israel to continue its illegal occupation and violation of Palestinians' rights.
An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court.
In the past several weeks, we've seen an escalation in ongoing Zionist attacks, invasions of Al-Aqsa Mosque and many areas in Jerusalem. We've seen repeated invasions of Jenin. We've seen ongoing attacks on demonstrations, on Palestinians defending their land. And that's really in Palestine from the river to the sea. And in many of these cases, these attacks have been accompanied by the mass detention and arrests of Palestinians.
The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
And even though the Israeli occupation's illegitimate military courts convict Palestinians over 99% of the time, they don't even have to do that. Instead, simply by issuing a military order, they can throw any Palestinian behind bars without charge or trial for up to 6 months at a time in a way that's indefinitely renewable. And this is what Israeli administrative detention looks like.
Currently, more than 2,400 Palestinians are serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts, and close to 1,500 others are being held for questioning, awaiting trial, or being tried. Meantime, Israel has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years.
According to Israeli rights groups, 2,441 Palestinians are currently serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts. A further 1,478 detainees are being held for questioning, have been charged and are awaiting trial, or are currently being tried. Last month, the Palestinian Prisoners Society, or the PPS, said the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. Palestinian authorities say 1,500 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces during the time span beginning at the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September 2000 up to April 2013. That's the equivalent of one Palestinian child killed every 3 days for about 13 years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's quite clear is that the so-called, you know, security domination of the Israeli occupation is very fragile. And in reality, the Palestinian resistance is exposing that on a daily basis. But that resistance is also taking place inside the prisons as well. Every single one of these over 600 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention are currently engaged in a collective boycott of the military courts to demand that this illegal system, an illegitimate system, come to an immediate end.
The Palestinian Prisoners Center for Studies, or the PCBS, said in a report in September last year that Israeli authorities had clearly escalated targeting Palestinian children. Systematic torture, harassment, and repression are all examples of the fashion in which the Israeli prison authorities treat Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli prison service keeps the prisoners under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Geneva Convention. Israel has for years held Palestinians in overcrowded prisons with poor hygiene standards.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Bazaar. Aluminum is the third most abundant metal found on Earth's crust. It is used everywhere, from space capsules to soda cans, but that hasn't always been the case. Surprisingly, aluminum used to be more expensive than gold. In fact, it was so precious that Napoleon used aluminum utensils while dining with guests as a gesture of wealth. Before the 19th century, making aluminum was both expensive and difficult. The new methods for isolating alumina to make the metal were discovered involving electrochemistry. These days, alumina is still continuously studied owing to its vast number of industrial and technological applications.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly program that analyzes markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and also internationally. This week, we will talk about the vast world of alumina production, its various uses, and markets. Plus, we will uncover how this seemingly simple item has made broad contributions to knowledge-based product development and the economy as a whole. So let's get started. We'll be right back.
To become more familiar with alumina and its related products, we visited Altus Alumina. It is a company that specializes in making fused alumina oxide. Now you might be wondering where fused alumina is used. Alumina has a very high melting point and is a crystal-type powder used in grinding, blasting, and cutting processes. Plus, it is an ingredient in various formulations to make things like fire-retardant glass and ceramic glaze. Fused alumina is also used to make various types of catalyst as well. Alumina doesn't quite naturally exist in nature. It is actually synthetically produced, which is no easy task. However, bauxite, which is the raw material alumina comes from, can be found in abundance in the country's mineral reserves. Bauxite ore is extracted from mines. Then it undergoes a refining process that includes digesting it in piping hot sodium hydroxide, where it's also electrocuted. Then it is filtered and fed to a rotary furnace where it dries at super high temperatures until it becomes a fine crystalline substance. The production facilities of this company are located in Khorasan-e-Razavi province. It is conveniently close to one of the largest bauxite mines in the country where it gets the majority of its raw material. It might be interesting to know that a lot of the equipment and technology used to make alumina in the country have all been domestically produced. That is significant because this machinery was previously imported through difficult custom processes, which were often time-consuming and, more importantly, very expensive. So indigenizing technology used in knowledge-based industries to produce value-added products is key to expanding the size of related markets. The beating heart of this company is its massive and high-tech research and development department. This knowledge-based company has obtained the technical know-how of producing various grades of alumina. This department carries out studies on the structural, physical, and chemical properties of alumina oxide and improve its performance for different uses. Customers can also make special requests depending on the product they want to make. The research and development department then creates the optimal formula of fused alumina to suit the customer's needs. On another note, while fused alumina is produced in small quantities by other companies, the quality of these productions is often fairly low. This has led industry participants to look to imports to meet their needs. However, this company has saved the country millions in imports while matching international standards for product quality. Presently, this knowledge-based firm is standing on the cusp of exporting its products. It hopes to gain a high share of foreign markets to meet regional demands. This is easily possible as fused alumina is not abundantly produced in the West Asian region and is typically imported into the area. As part of its future vision, this company wants to expand this particular industry to produce high-quality products. It also wants to introduce new items that can be used in down-the-line industries. From laminates and paints to concrete, cement, and tiles, alumina is an important ingredient in numerous products. Iran is a leading producer of many of these items that it also exports to neighboring regions. But alumina is mainly used to make the metal we are all familiar with, which is aluminum. And Iran's market is thriving with aluminum ingot production skyrocketing in recent years. Official figures show Iran is among the top 15 producers of aluminum in the world. Last year, Iran produced over 400,000 tons of aluminum ingots, which is roughly 55,000 tons more than the year before. That is based on figures from the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization, also known by the acronym IMIDRO. Going off the figures from IMIDRO, the total production of aluminum has roughly doubled over the past 2 years. This comes as aluminum bauxite production surged by well over 13% in the same period. Last year, around 1 million tons of bauxite were produced. Meanwhile, the government is planning on increasing annual aluminum production to 1.5 million tons by the year 2026. This means that alumina production must also increase accordingly. So, how many bauxite reserves are there in the country? Iran has one major bauxite mine, which is located in North Khorasan province. Jojarong mine has an estimated total of 30 million tons of reserves, but only 7 million tons of it are proven reserves. This mine is owned by Iran's sole alumina producing company, which is also owned by Imidro. So far, this company has explored and owned nearly 20 bauxite zones in various areas nationwide. But these zones are primarily used as extra feed for the Jojarong alumina refinery. Iran is well known for its copious mineral reserves. In fact, the country has over 60 billion tons of mineral reserves, of which some 40 billion tons are proven reserves. That is based on figures from the National Geological Survey and Mineral Exploration Agency. The Ministry of Mining says the productions in this sector are worth some $22 billion. But so far, productions haven't met this potential value. Industry participants say the country is not using all of its mining potentials. There are several reasons for this. One is the need to further develop the technology and research necessary to expand this sector. Areas that need more attention are geological exploration to discover new reserves and calculating mineable reserves. Plus, there are lucrative investment opportunities for engineering extraction and refining equipment. But that's not all. Once the results are in, related bodies with the know-how to conduct necessary material research are also needed to develop products. And here is where knowledge-based companies, such as the one we just mentioned, play a big role in the mining sector. Presently, there are well over 7,000 knowledge-based companies in Iran. One of this amount, nearly 900 of them, are active in the field of advanced materials and products that are based on chemical technologies. In its transition to a knowledge-based economy, the government has stepped up its support for knowledge-based firms and research institutions. Through the Science and Technology Office and the National Innovation Fund, the government has provided provisions that encourage activities in the mining field. Despite Iran being the third most sanctioned country by the United States, it has made major gains in its industrial developments and added value productions. Such efforts have led to self-sufficiency in many sectors.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there in the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
Rich in diverse climatic conditions and creative and talented growers have given Iran a unique potential for production of horticultural crops. Today, we will visit one of the successful companies active in the horticulture business.
Our company, Payovart Asa, is active in business of horticulture. We are a grower of roses and we also build greenhouses. We build modern greenhouses that are suitable for growers who want to improve their productivity and efficiency. We act as an agent for Cordis Rosen Company and propagate at least 100 different types of cut and garden roses in our greenhouses. They are very popular among the growers of roses in Iran because normally they are imported from foreign countries. We are also greenhouse builders. We build wide-span greenhouses that are very suitable for being used in Iran's climate, which is dry and hot. Our company has been in this business for at least 20 years. We have tried to transfer foreign companies' knowledge to Iran.
This company is an affiliate of the Cordis Rosen Company, which is one of the most renowned and innovative breeders of garden roses, cut roses and pot roses in the world, with a network of agents and licensees in over 30 countries across the globe. Fragrance is often sacrificed by breeders seeking to create disease-free roses, but what makes Cordis roses unique is that, in addition to high marks for being disease-resistant, they also produce rich fragrance and beautiful colors. This company designs, builds, and equips greenhouses based on the types of vegetation growers want to produce. Their main activity is propagating different varieties of roses. They also have different sites in their greenhouses for growing various indoor plants.
Kayovard Asa is producing young roses with the same quality as European companies, but at half the price. I think that's the main feature of our company. So instead of importing young roses to Iran, we are exporting them to other countries. The main advantage of our company is that we have transferred the knowledge of foreign companies to Iran, particularly in designing and equipping greenhouses. We send lots of experts to European countries to know how to grow different plants. We have regular tests on the soil and water in greenhouses. It helps us to produce healthier products, especially seedlings of roses. It means every week or month we have tests on the water, and according to its analysis, we can decide which type of fertilizers or chemicals are needed to be added to it.
According to studies, Iran is ranked 17th in the world in terms of volume, tonnage, and capacity of ornamental flowers production. But in the field of exports, it ranks 80th to 90th in the world, so there is a lot of room for improvement in that area. Every 100 rose petals is worth a barrel of oil.
We have exported large quantities of cut flowers and young roses to different countries, including Russia, in recent years. That's due to the high quality of our products as well as the reasonable prices. Kayovard Asa company has a plan to establish a tissue culture lab with a capacity of at least 5 million plants per year. It means we will produce young plants, seedlings of different varieties of trees or other plants in Iran that are very safe, healthy, and reliable for different growers in both horticulture and agriculture businesses.
We are almost out of time for the program, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in the mining and related sectors. The need for electricity increases as Iranian industries such as aluminum production expand. So the Energy Ministry has several plans in the works to respond to growing domestic electricity needs, particularly during summer peak use.
The ministry is planning on launching several new power plants. One of these plants will produce over 300 megawatts of power and will come online in the coming month in southern Iran. Officials say the new plant will use the domestically produced F-class gas turbine in a combined cycle system. The Ministry of Energy predicts the country could face a shortage of 10 gigawatts of power on the peak summer days. Iran is also considering resuming electricity imports from Azerbaijan as part of its electricity exchange to keep up with energy needs. Last year, the country experienced blackouts as a result of power shortages.
Mining industry participants are calling on the government to lift a ban and ease tariff imports of heavy-duty vehicles and some mining machinery.
Under the ban, companies cannot import 150-ton dump trucks and 200-ton leading machinery. This has forced large mining companies to work at only 50% capacity and small and mid-sized mines to the brink of closure altogether. Companies say the ban needs revision as it treats heavy-duty mining vehicles the same as luxury cars. They say to import these essential items, they have to pay twice the price of the vehicle value. The government banned these items a few years ago in a bid to encourage domestic production. But local productions of heavy-duty vehicles have not yet caught up with the massive demand, leaving mining companies feeling the squeeze. Currently, the mining sector needs some 25,000 machines and vehicles to operate at a normal capacity.
All things considered, Iran is still a major producer and exporter of mineral products. Last year, Iran's mineral exports reached record high figures to show for it.
Some 53,000 tons of mineral products were exported last year. According to the Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization, these exports were worth nearly $12 billion. Topping the export charts was steel products, which raked in nearly $7 billion. This was closely followed by copper and related products at $2 billion. Cement and nickel also recorded high export values. These figures reveal a near 80% rise in foreign revenues for this sector.
That wraps up our program for today. Don't forget to leave us your feedback. If you have a topic you're interested in, you can send us your thoughts and suggestions via email. We always enjoy hearing from you. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli.
After talking about halal income and the dangers of not taking care about how we earn our money and how spiritually polluting an impure and illegitimate income would be, there are different kinds of ways of earning money and different types of methods of expenditures and ways of spending. And I think the one important thing for us to always remember that I'm going to be repeating frequently is to remember two important points that we can see that are frequently mentioned in our religion, Islam. Number one is balance. Number two is rida and being happy and content with what you have. Balance, as the Quran says, don't lock your fist, your hand as a fist tight to your neck, and don't be greedy, and don't open your hand all the way, which means
Don't be careless when it comes to, or reckless when it comes to money issues. Have balance. When it comes to content, when it comes to rida, be happy with what you have. Stop looking over the fence. Stop always comparing yourself to someone who is financially higher than you. In that case, you're always going to be eating yourself from with inside. You're always going to be miserable, you know. And then those other very evil kind of inside, batani, evil traits start to appear. The most dangerous of them is greed. The most dangerous of them is hasad and enviness. And of course that becomes, you know, the worst of worst when it comes to you as a human being.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
There are many lessons
of the book
by those prophets. And
eat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another important point is when it comes to tijara, is to remember that there are ad'iyah, there are supplications that a person should use, should recite at the time of business, at the time of wanting rizq, and things like that. Now, of course, you don't want to be a person, when it does come to affairs of business, as Ayatollah Jawadi Amali says, you don't want to be that person who always, you know, is lies or deceives or unfaithful or disloyal or deceiving when it comes to business transactions and things like that. When it comes to ribh, when it comes to having profits, be reasonable in the profit that you want to make. You know, don't overdo it. You know, laysa min al-muru'ah al-ribh ala al-akhwan. You know, it's not chivalry. It's not a chivalrous thing for a person to gain profit from their brethren. A lot of these things that speak about remembering that a person should not dallis, should not deceive, should not have ghish. Man ghasha musliman fi shira'in aw bay'in falaysa minna. If you deceive a fellow Muslim in buying something or in selling something, then you are not considered to be a Muslim. And there's one, two, three full pages that speak about deception and deceiving and being fraudulent in business transactions. And of course, many of these ahadith speak about how evil a person is. If you were to lie, if you were to, you know, deceive, if you were to try to rip someone off, as we usually say.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, again, there are certain kind of mu'amalat that a person should, or a certain kind of business transactions that a person should stay away from, that a person should avoid. And that is when it comes to dealing with the case of, for example, we gave the example of dogs. If the dog is not used for hunting, if the dog is not used for as a shepherd, if the dog, then of course, a guarding dog, then of course, such an example of transaction, buying or selling, would of course be classified as halal. There's one hadith, for example, that sometimes there are certain acts that are classified as makruh when it does come to transaction and business and things like that. I think an important point again here that needs to be mentioned is having a skill. And that's the fourth point here that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli says. To have a skill, to have a hirfa, to have a san'ah. And whatever that skill may be, as long as it's halal, as long as this skill is halal, then of course we need to continue on in remembering that there's that whole topic of having balance in everything that we need to do. And of course, especially when it comes to the financial side. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
This isn't just some corporate takeover, said one critic, adding, this is about a set of very specific moves that oligarchs have been taking that have gradually concentrated economic, political, and discursive power in fewer and fewer hands. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Real Threat to Democracy. Musk buys Twitter for $44 billion. Here's the details. April 25, 2022, rights advocates, public health experts, and media critics were among those who warned that the purchase of Twitter by mega-billionaire Elon Musk, the world's richest person, creates a direct threat to democracy and the common good by putting the outsized power of the social media platform used by hundreds of millions worldwide into the hands of one man. The social media company accepted Musk's offer to purchase Twitter for $44 billion, or $54.20 $1 per share, leading some critics to note other ways the enormous sum of money could have been spent rather than on what Representative Chai Garcia called the vanity project boondoggle to silence Musk's critics. Tax the rich, Garcia said on Twitter. Musk's purchase has led to concern that former President Donald Trump's Twitter account will be reinstated. Trump was banned from the platform in January 2021 after violating its rules by inciting his followers to violently attack the U.S. Capitol in an effort to stop the certification of the 2020 presidential election results. Musk hasn't just purchased another expensive Playtoy, but a global online community that includes about 330 million regular users, said Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of Free Press, adding, "With control of such a massive platform comes great responsibility, and Musk hasn't shown he has the capacity to be accountable to this diverse online community." She added, noting Musk's own history of using Twitter to intimidate and disparage others, including journalists, elected officials, owners of competing businesses, and anyone else who might challenge his views. With Musk at the helm, Gonzalez said, Twitter must improve its content moderation practices and stop amplifying bigotry and conspiracy theories that pollute public discourse, threaten the health and safety of users, and undermine democracy. Musk has criticized Twitter's efforts to moderate the platform, saying early this month that he believes it's just really important that people have the reality and the perception that they are able to speak freely within the bounds of the law, and that the civilizational risk is decreased the more we can increase the trust of Twitter as a public platform. Journalist Anand Giridharas said that by taking over Twitter and claiming he will protect the platform, as the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated, Musk is doing is what plutocrats have been doing, branding themselves the solution to the very problem they are. This isn't just some corporate takeover, he said, adding, this is about a set of very specific moves that oligarchs have been taking that have gradually concentrated economic, political, and discursive power in fewer and fewer hands. As Media Matters reported recently, right-wing politicians in the U.S. have been in favor of Musk's purchase since he first offered to buy the platform earlier this month. Representative Jim Jordan led 18 House Republicans in writing to Twitter's board of directors demanding that the board preserve all records related to Musk's bid. The right's propagandist had celebrated Musk's bid as a way to garner political gain by ending the company's purported political censorship, reported senior fellow Matt Gertz, adding, then its elected GOP champions, responding to hesitation from and when Twitter's board raised the prospect of a costly congressional investigation if his offer wasn't accepted. While Twitter was a large and powerful company before Musk's takeover was announced, said Sana Said of Al Jazeera, the purchase does underscore an unnerving trend. The ability of a single man to purchase something that impacts hundreds of millions beyond users in order to influence it in its own image. It's less than great when billionaires own sports teams, which bind communities together as their playthings, said Robert Weisman, president of consumer advocacy group Public Citizen, adding, having a billionaire-owned Twitter a vital platform for communication and community, as his plaything is far more serious. It's a real threat to democracy.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.